So now I want to turn to the subject of modernity, post-modernity, post-modernism, if you like. This is a movement in our time which affects both Muslims and Christians. And some of you will have read the writings, or some parts of the writings, of Ahmed, Dr. Professor Ahmed Akbar S. Ahmed. Akbar S. Ahmed. There are several books that he has, and some of them are in the library. But I want to quote from his fascinating book, Postmodernism and Islam. So we're talking about postmodernism. Postmodernism and Islam. The subtitle is Predicament and Promise. It's a predicament for Muslims, but it's a promise for Muslims. It's a predicament for Christians, and it's a promise, too, for Christians. And in the preface, he dedicates his book to his two-year-old daughter. I think by now she's about six. Her name is Nafis, and he lives actually in Britain and often appears on TV and radio, and he writes from that country. But he says, Nafis will live as a Muslim in the post-modern world, which is just beginning to shape our lives. Therein lies the Muslim predicament, that is, that of living by Islam in an age which is increasingly secular, cynical, irreverent, fragmented, materialistic, and therefore for a Muslim, often hostile. In an age of cynicism, he's talking about Britain, and that's where he lives. So he's talking about the world, but out of that environment, he writes. In an age of cynicism and disintegration, Islam has much to offer. I therefore pray she finds inspiration in her faith and culture to assist her in making sense of and resolving the predicament of living as a good, caring and decent human being in the post-modernist world. So this is a concern for the Christian just as much as for the Muslim. It's a concern for us as much as for Akbar Ahmed and bringing up his daughter, because the world is being very greatly changed by urbanization, changed by economics, changed by political instability, by population growth, the changing role of women, technology. Email is changing our lives to some extent, at least it's changed mine. Shifting world economies. You think of Korea and its economy and some of these. The closing of countries, sometimes making the closing of countries to Christians from outside visiting and ministering. The Islamic resurgence, and Muslims would look at it at the resurgence of other religions. These influences affect, to a great extent, Muslims and Christians. And we have thought often in terms of the usual categories in approaching Muslims. We thought of different types of Muslims with different viewpoints. And we've touched briefly on what Islam might soon look like, or even does look like, in Cairo or in the great centres of population. What does it look like in Karachi? What does it look like in Jakarta? It's changing, because so many people are coming to the city and being cut off from their roots, and having to work together in the workplace and having to mix in ways they never expected. And the common denominator is not always religion. It is something else. And so we get a mixture which breaks down the structures of both Islam and the Christian church. Christian church doesn't have many structures. It ought to have structured, welcoming communities and welcoming to Muslims welcoming to any who come from outside. It's a bit lacking sometimes. Muslim community is very strong, and there are so many codes and so many ways in which the whole culture and the community are maintained. But these are dropping away in the large cities of Africa and in Asia. And so we can say that Ahmed speaks as a Muslim for whom Islam covers every aspect of life. For the Christian as well, belief should cover every aspect of life. Truth and morality are not relative, but absolute. And this is my conclusion to my book here on submitting to God. For me, it is the Christian faith which claims every aspect of my living and my dying. From a biblical perspective, I see no need for competition, estrangement or hostility between Muslims and Christians, or between Muslims and Christians and those of other convictions. I believe in the uniqueness of the revelation of God in Christ, but I always want to share this faith in love and humility. So I feel that as Christians we have a tremendous opportunity in this postmodern world, and Ahmed feels he's got a great opportunity too, and he wants to train his daughter and teach his daughter so that he can live in this very changed world. The Muslim world that I went to 45 years ago is very different from the Muslim world of today, but in some places it's mind-boggling, the change. When you get globalization, you can go to the remote part of Central Asia and you'll find Coca-Cola, and you can there's a common youth culture, youth in Indonesia, youth in China, youth in Albania, youth in Britain, youth in the US. They are more close because of singing, the songs that are sung, and the clothes that people wear, the way youth act. They're more close than they have ever been. It's a culture, it's a kind of globalization, as it were. It's the effect of it that makes songs sung by young people in Los Angeles well known to songs sung by young people in Pakistan. So this is an interesting thing. And postmodernism. And I'd like to just read you one or two other points. I'm reading them because I wrote them. That's easy to. It's easier to speak when I'm. Okay. Muslim fundamentalists may feel on the defensive. Well, I'll go back to the beginning here. I have an article which you'll get, or have perhaps, through Thoroughly Modern Muslims. Thoroughly Modern Muslims. Throughout the modern world, the centrality of family values, ethnic and linguistic identity, and personal faith are being swept aside to focus on a shallow but universal culture. Universal culture. See, young people tend to have almost a universal culture now because of the, you've got all this coming over the radio, the TV, there's tremendous interchange of peoples, and so youth in many places like to do the same thing and sing the same songs in Asia and Africa and in North America, Britain, Europe. So this international culture is communicated through a vast network of advertising, sports, films and television. The veneer of this new global culture pushes God and faith values to the side to such an extent that their relevance to daily life is portrayed as almost negligible. So keen Muslims, devout Muslims, face the same problem as Christians in this matter. Because religion is marginalised. It is certainly privatised. I like to talk about the reality, but I like to talk about the privatisation of religion. In the West, we have privatised our religion. You can believe what you like, but it doesn't affect the public marketplace or the public scene. It's not supposed to. You're supposed to keep your religion private. Sometimes I think I'm perhaps right in thinking that it's rather excluded from the educational system, so it's privatized out of that, and it's maybe that's why there's so much homeschooling. I don't know. You can interpret your culture to me at the next coffee break or something. But we still have some biblical teaching in schools in Britain, but it's getting pushed out. It's by law that we're supposed to have some. I suppose you may have a different view from the American perspective. But anyway, what's ending up is privatized Christianity. And it's not... and the Muslims are being pressed into a position of not being able to maintain sometimes the structures of society. And but they're working hard at it, whereas Christians don't seem to be working quite so hard at it. They are working in Britain to have separate schools for girls, separate schools for boys, to have schools which are mostly Muslim and where they can give training in Islam. There are other movements in Britain by which Muslims seek to bring in the structures of Islam which are familiar in Pakistan or of Bangladesh or a strongly Muslim country, but are not generally so well known or implemented where Muslims are in minority. They are preparing for the day when they will be in majority. And I have the text here somewhere of the objectives of the Council of Europe. And London is the main objective for the Islamization of Europe. And they hope that within 20, 30 years, there will be that possibility. And they are establishing cultural centres and mosques in key places throughout Europe. The Council of Europe, its objectives are very clear and they are published. There must be such a plan for North America. I've just been talking to one student here. He's writing his thesis on the Islamization of New York, because probably in 30 years' time, the structures that Muslims want to set, they will be there. I want to read his thesis. He's not done it yet, but he's working on it. But we have to have a projection. Islam is the fastest growing religion in the world, as far as I know. Certainly it's the second fastest growing religion in the United States, as Dr. Carl Ellis will tell you. So Muslim fundamentalists may feel on the defensive and react to the modern scene at one extreme. I see Muslim fundamentalists at one extreme, and I see Salman Rushdie as a postmodern novelist reacting at the other. You might not have think that there's much link between Salman Rushdie and the fundamentalists, but there is, because they're both reacting to the postmodern world, and they're doing it in opposite directions. So Rushdie is a postmodernist novel writer and writer. Some of the fundamentalists are reacting against what they see on the modern scene. They are both Muslims, or sets of Muslims, engaging with a secular pluralist and disintegrating Western world and seeking answers. Just as the fundamentalist has his own clear theological position, so from Salman Rushdie's point of view, the rejection of orthodox belief or the adoption of agnosticism is itself a position. I mean, that's his position. At some point he's declared himself an agnostic, but occasionally he's certainly rejected orthodox belief, but in other places, more recently, he's turned closer to his Muslim origins. E.M. Foster, well-known writer, said, "I do not believe in belief." And in an article in the Sunday Times, the Sunday Independent, one of the leading newspapers in Britain, this is what Rushdie wrote about this. Rushdie echoes this, "I do not believe in belief," when he declares, "I believe in no God. And where there is no belief, there is no blasphemy." He's Muslim. He was born Muslim in Bombay. And you probably know a certain amount of about Salman Rushdie. Don't take his satanic verses on your travels. I keep my copy in Britain. Postmodernism, then, a challenge for Muslims and Christians. The postmodern relativistic religion of tolerance challenges Muslims as much as Christians. The devout Muslim lives in the knowledge that Islam covers every aspect of life and that truth and morality are not relevant, relative, but absolute. See, now this is our problem as Christians. Our societies here and in Europe are coming into situations where truth is relative. Truth for most Europeans is relative and not absolute. Truth for Christians is absolute. Truth for Muslims is absolute. But through the influence of postmodernism, we have a situation in which the majority of people make truth relative. The Christian position is parallel to the Muslim position. Although through the influence of secular humanism, many Christians have sometimes, I've already said, that they have privatized their religion and forgotten the world view of the Bible and its absolute standards. Postmodernism, in the prevailing intellectual climate of the West today, means we have moved from an era of rationalism and materialism into a kind of unreason, where there is no absolute truth or ethical standard. Many people believe anything that seems to offer to fulfill the spiritual void. The postmodern mind seems to be marked by gullibility, bringing in a new paganism. Am I describing your society? This is of great concern to the practicing Muslim as well as to the committed Christian. Clifford Longley, in his Friday column, in the Daily Telegraph in March 1996, noted that postmodernism rejects the idea of universal moral truth. Postmodernism renders impossible the very idea of objective universal truth. We all make our own universes, and they are all equally valid. And then there are postmodernists within the church, who may well confuse us as well as our Muslim friends. For example, Dr. Donald Cupid, he's Dean of Emmanuel College, Cambridge, and he writes on dialogue and various other subjects. He wrote on the myth of the incarnation. I think it was a collection of essays. I have read it. It causes lots of trouble in Muslim countries. In Pakistan, it caused trouble. They immediately took it up. Here is a Christian leader, a lecturer in a university on the Christian faith, and he talks about the myth of the incarnation. Today, left-wing postmodernists like me, says Donald Cupid, are turning religion into something like art. Believers must continuously reinvent their own faith. So I call this pick and mix, actually. You please yourself, and it's not that you believe nothing. It's you take a bit of this and a bit of that, and this is the New Age atmosphere. Okay, Muslims are facing this as well as Christians. This is my point. I keep on saying it. And so in some ways, we are close to people like Ahmed. So we have to think how we are going to address Muslims who are facing this kind of challenge just as we are, or how we are facing a whole generation of sometime kinds of Muslims who don't actually believe in God and who are caught into postmodernism. So here are a few suggestions. Lifestyle backed up by personal testimony will have great appeal if you're trying to minister to this kind of person. The examination of mutual themes in the Bible and Quran may eventually lead to a discussion on authority and the possibility of some practical cooperation in common areas in relation, for example, to ecology and environmental issues, the sanctity of life, we talked about it yesterday, in relation to abortion, relief and rehabilitation projects. Those Muslims influenced by the New Age generally have a pick and mix approach. One needs to find out where they are and start from there, their felt needs and fears. Don't assume he or she is a Muslim, so will believe the same as other Muslims. The Muslim who claims that belief is entirely a personal matter governing one's private life will probably be more interested in man rather than God. He or she culturally remains a Muslim, but is strongly influenced by secular humanism. A more meaningful approach might be through the views of man expressed by the poet Muhammad Iqbal. This would be especially relevant for Pakistanis and Indians. Young people caught in between two or three shifting cultures need a special and sympathetic approach. I mean, this is going to affect how Muslims bring up their children in this cultural situation today, where we see not just one cultural situation, as it were, shifting culture. And we should note the growing possibilities on the internet. For example, there's a project, Cafe Medina, it's on the internet. It's a proposed scheme to link all mosques and Islamic schools in the UK to each other and to the internet. A Muslim leader said last year that he wanted to see Muslim children become as one with the internet and all the tools that are necessary to comprehend this new, massively expanding medium of communication. He noted that it will provide places of recreation and education and result in the emergence of a new culture. So he wanted thoroughly modern Muslims, and he intends to use the internet for the building of his community and as one way of building it. Okay, maybe you have a question? We've got time for one question.
It's interesting to think of him wanting to make the internet so close because he can get so much stuff on it that doesn't relate to Islam or, I mean, anyone. You think of the kids, the child pornography and all that kind of thing that is so easily accessed.
But you can get anything you want on the internet. Mm-hmm. So you don't have to touch that lot. You touch what you want. And he's urging Muslim leaders and young people to use to the full this new tool of communication, and it does strengthen some links. I have a friend who went as a missionary to Brazil in 1950, and I've only seen her once since that time. We were at school together. But just recently, we've both gone into the internet, so links become closer. But it applies in a broad sense. The internet is a kind of tool which can affect very closely how communities function and how individuals function. Yes?
Yeah, I was just going to say, my understanding also is that the web pages that the Muslims are setting up on the internet are done for evangelism also.
Yes.
They set up the chat rooms to answer questions of people who are coming in to, you know, and try to convert them through the internet rather than having to go out through the world. But they're using it also as an evangelization tool.
Yeah. Yes. I mean, I hear accounts of Christians using the internet to share the Christian faith. We can be quite sure that Muslims are using it equally as much to share Islam, because Islam, like Christianity, is a missionary faith.